welcome.
All right. No. It's not that. Okay. I said it's not that hard. I'm an expert.
There's no non-cringe way to start a podcast.
There's not. Welcome to For the Medical Record.
Good job. No, really. That was really good. I'm going to use that.
All right. I am Antoine Johnson.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
And we are postdoctoral research fellows here at Johns Hopkins University in the Department of the History of Medicine and the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine.
Today, we're really, really excited to share with you our conversation with Carolyn Suffren,
who is an amazing associate professor of gynecology and obstetrics, also holds a PhD in medical anthropology. Dr. Suffren's research interests include incarcerated women in reproductive health care, racism in health care. Dr. Suffren is also the author of the amazing book, Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars.
Yeah, so we're going to talk to her about her work relating to her book, Jail Care, relating to the group ARWIP, which stands for Advocacy and Research on Reproductive Wellness of Incarcerated People. We're going to have a really wide-ranging conversation about how Dr. Suffren says reproduction is everything and why it's so important to her and her work. And she also poses the really important question, what does it mean to care in a space of punishment? So yeah, we're really looking forward to this conversation, and we hope that you enjoy listening to it.
Peace.
Thank you. Should we jump into it?
Are you ready? It's going to be the interview of your life, okay? Okay, so Carolyn, could you tell us how you came to your work with the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine, looking for how you came to do an MD, PhD, and if you could share with our listeners what that means?
Absolutely. I will share first the path that led me to it, and then what it means for me. And it started when I was in college, and I was an anthropology major who was also keen on going to medical school, although I hadn't really fully processed why, but was just sort of on that path. And I took my first anthropology course, the anthropology of gender, and my whole world exploded in a good way. And through exploring critical feminist theory and, you know, a little bit of science and technology studies, really came to question my decision to go to medical school and become a physician, because I learned just how socially, culturally contingent the system was, and how all the structures, well, not all at that point, I had not fully appreciated, but the many systems of harm, the many assumptions that are built into what I had taken for granted as just, this is, you know, that this is medicine. And I learned through anthropology that nothing is taken for granted, including medicine, healthcare, science. So it was that initial path of questioning and that falling into anthropology that started me on my path. I still did go to medical school, but it was a harder decision than I thought. I thought about going to graduate school to get a PhD in anthropology. Now, at that time, there really weren't many options for combining MD and PhD in anthropology. So I didn't really think of it much at that point. And then as I started medical school, I just still felt the pull of anthropology and its value in not only in the world in general, but especially within healthcare and the critical lens that it brings, whether it's to patient encounters or to understanding health. And so I was encouraged to take a year off and get a master's in medical anthropology, which I did, and it was fantastic. I was given the opportunity to stay on and do the PhD. But at that point, I didn't, other than valuing the frameworks and critical lens that anthropology gave to me, I didn't have a topic that compelled me enough to really commit to the deep work that happens to do doctoral level training in anthropology and in, you know, similar to other social sciences and humanities. So I went back to medical school, finished medical school. I decided to go into OBGYN, which actually was not a revelation. That is in large part what compelled me to go into medicine in the first place, because, and this again relates back to my interest in anthropology, to me, especially as an anthropologist who studies reproduction, reproduction to me is everything. It tells us so much about human history, about sociality, about inequities, about controlling processes on the bodies, so much of our society's values. And so for me, going into OBGYN, just it made a lot of sense to bring what I valued in anthropology and the critical feminist lens that I brought. It just made sense. As I was in the midst of my clinical training, I had an encounter with a patient that was another, everything just exploded and changed my career path, which is that I delivered the baby of a woman who was shackled to the bed. This is not something you get exposed to in medical school. It's not something that I ever conceived was possible. It's not like I thought, I'm never going to deliver the baby of a woman who is shackled to the bed. And then I did. It was more just that scenario never even entered into my consciousness until I was part of it. And I realized I'd never thought about the fact that there were women behind bars. I'd never thought about the fact that there were pregnant people behind bars. And I was so struck in that moment and disturbed, not as much as the birthing person herself, but I felt like all the Foucault that I had read in undergrad and in my master's degree, it was just all coming into that delivery room, history of sexuality, discipline and punished, and even a little bit of madness and civilization. And it was all just there. And what is happening with this, this instantiation of state violence at this moment, this incredibly vulnerable and intense moment of birth. And then I was also troubled by my own complicity in this. That combination of things of just like, whoa, what is happening with state violence, in this moment of reproduction and procreation, and what is happening with my complicity in this act of state violence, that again drew me back to anthropology. And I started to learn more and become more interested in the intersections between reproduction and incarceration. Then when I finished my residency training and I moved out to San Francisco and started a clinical fellowship in complex family planning to further hone my skills in abortion care and complex contraception, with this fellowship, I was encouraged to pursue my interests in reproductive health care for incarcerated women, which is really was not something that I had, even though I was learning about, I hadn't quite identified it as an interest of mine. So I credit my mentors for seeing that. And I started working at the San Francisco County Jail as a doctor, just providing OBGYN care about once a week. But boy, it did not take long of being in that space and providing care or trying to provide care in a space of punishment that I got drawn in and compelled and troubled by all the contradictions and complexities of what I was witnessing and what I was, again, complicit in. What does it mean to care in a space of punishment? I began quickly to see all these contradictions. And I felt like at that point, I needed the tools of anthropology, of ethnography, social theory, of critical analysis to help me sort through some of those questions. And also relatedly, I sensed that there was something different or additive besides, the very common and appropriate narrative of the racialized violence of mass incarceration and its dehumanization. There was more going on there. And so it was being dually positioned as a physician with an amateur, I guess, or some anthropological training that pushed me further along into question assumptions about what's happening in this environment.
Ooh. That was such a good answer.
I know so much about your work, but I think it's so helpful to always hear how people personally came to it. It makes their work so much more human, and it helps people who are also still figuring out their big research questions to see how it can happen, whether it's mentors or just that one patient encounter or whatever it may be. We're definitely going to come back to your work with reproduction, incarceration, state violence, etc. But I want to just dive a little bit deeper into, you mentioned some of the methods that you were using within medical anthropology, and a lot of that is familiar to me as a historian. You talked about Foucault, you talked about feminist critical theory, but I would love to hear some more about what exactly a medical anthropologist does and what kind of methods medical anthropologists use.
Well, medical anthropologists use a lot of different methods. The cornerstone, I would say, similar to sociocultural anthropologists, is ethnography. We also incorporate, historical analysis and some archival research, although certainly not with the expertise of a historian. But yeah, ethnography is really the cornerstone. So what is ethnography? Some ways that it's described, in the words of classic cultural anthropologist Clifford Geertz, it's about being there. And then another common phrase is participant observation. the Komaroff's anthropologists, they have described anthropology's goal as making the strange familiar and the familiar strange. And so ways that you do that with ethnography are yourself. You are part of the instrument of the research. And so what you do is you immerse yourself in a community or a problem, and you are there. You are physically there. You're observing what's happening around you, but you're also participating. That's where the participant observation comes from. And the classic, you know, cultural anthropologists of, you know, often aligned with colonial projects were to go to remote villages in lands that the empires were trying to colonize and would live in villages and understand their kinship systems and their food ways and document and try to understand how this society, how this culture worked and how people related to each other, what moved them, what was meaningful. And so, while certainly there is a very appropriate and warranted critique of some of the earlier colonial projects of anthropology, there's still, you know, the notion of the ethnographer being part of the research tool is still there, because as humans, we can train ourselves to observe not just what people are saying in a given space or around a given problem, but what they're not saying. And what are the gestures? What are the things that go unsaid? What are the tones? What are the actions? Things that you can observe and things that you wouldn't pick up on if you were just coming in not knowing anything about a place and observing. You also have to learn a little bit about it so you can pick up on what's a pattern, what's a deviation, what is unusual. And so some things I to say about ethnography and anthropological research are that, unlike, say, you know, biostatistical research or other quantitative research methodologies, sometimes in ethnography, it's the outliers that matter, you know, that teach you about what's going on. Like a pregnant person shackled, that is an outlier. And I wish it would never happen, but at least it should always be an outlier. And so that gives us a way to look into other things we might not have thought of. And it may not happen that often, but the fact that it happened a non-zero amount of times makes it worthy of inquiry, of study, and of rectifying the situation. So now getting to, what does that look like? What does being there actually look like? What did I do for my ethnography, which was at the San Francisco County Jail, which I should say, it's not typical. And there are many methodological and ethical complexities to doing ethnography in a place where one also practices medicine, which is something I've grappled with a lot. But that is where I did my ethnographic fieldwork, in the San Francisco jail. And so what did that look like? Well, it meant that I would go to the jail and just be there for hours at a time. And I would, some weeks, I would sort of focus my participant observation energy, what I've written elsewhere, observant participation, because I was already participating in this world of the San Francisco jail before I stepped back to be an ethnographer. But I would be in spaces with the deputies or the correctional custody officers. So I would sit with them at their guard tower or in the rooms where they look at the surveillance videos or at the desks in the holding area. And there were some weeks where I would be with the healthcare staff in the clinic in the jail or on their pill call rounds where they distribute medications to incarcerated patients. And there were some weeks where I spent more time, much of my time with the incarcerated individuals themselves in their housing units, spending time with them at mealtimes and during activities, and when there were no activities, sitting with them in the waiting area of the clinic in the jail. And then I would also spend time with all of these groups of individuals outside of the jail, and whether it was, you know, going out for a meal with them or sitting on a sidewalk or trying to help them, you know, get some food at McDonald's or taking them to a court appearance and then observing what happened at a court appearance. So it really is, I think being there is a really accurate and simple way to convey a lot of complexity of what happens, but that's what you're doing. And all the while you're observing, like those things that I said, the gestures, the eye rolls, the jokes, the things that go unsaid, the things that go said, who's talking to whom.
And, you know, some of what you're saying chimes with what historians do as well. You know, you're talking about the things that aren't said, things that are missing, just like as historians, we're looking for what's missing from the archive or you know, who isn't represented and how to find their stories, or how we can tell those stories through what hasn't been said or what traces might be left. So there are some interesting overlaps, I think, between, you know, your methods and then our methods as, you know, Antoine's a historian of medicine. I'm an art historian. So I found that really interesting.
Yeah. And shout out my colleague. You're familiar with Carlos Martinez. He's a medical anthropologist. I'm a medical historian. And we share a lot about our work, you know, him being a participant observer at the California-Mexico border, you know, with asylum seekers. He's working on his monograph right now. So, and I love medical anthropologists in general. I use a lot of their theories.
Cool. So cool.
Especially the syndemic theory. Like it shows up everywhere in my work. But back on topic. Sorry, we're just, you know, having such a good time. But, you know, talking about your work with incarcerated women, you created an organization, RWIP for short, Advocacy and Research on Reproductive Wellness for Incarcerated People. You know, the group's goal, as the website says, is, quote, to champion the reproductive well-being of incarcerated women and to create a world where they can thrive in their communities, end quote. Could you tell us a bit more about how your colleagues go about doing this, you know, championing reproductive well-being, making sure that people can thrive, however that may look? Please share more about that.
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing up that work. I created this group to give sort of an umbrella and a home to the many diverse activities and projects that I and my various colleagues on our team were doing, and to unify it. Even if, you know, there might be different manifestations and methodologies of the projects we were doing, they were all oriented towards a common goal. And we were very, as you can imagine, intentional in the language we used in naming, although I will say the acronym and how it sounds, maybe we could probably workshop that a little more. But we didn't want to use reproductive health. We didn't want to use reproductive rights. And I, as a white woman, didn't want to co-opt reproductive justice, although that is absolutely a central part of the work that I do. And I'm led by the teachings of, you know, the leaders and other activists in the movement. But we wanted to be broad and inclusive, again, with that, you know, coming back to that earlier comment I mentioned about why I went into OBGYN, because for me, reproduction is everything. It sure is. And reproductive justice is a framework that reminds us that the ideas of human procreation, they connect with so many different processes and structures in our society. And so for our research group, RWIP, we think of that as conducting research and engaging in public discussions and public spheres and making our research useful to all kinds of people who are working to make change, useful to and responsive to the issues identified by people on the ground trying to make change. Research that can be used to address and improve the reproductive well-being. And sometimes that might mean improving reproductive health care delivery in prisons and jails. Sometimes that means research that sheds light on bigger picture things to promote reproductive well-being, i.e., maybe the best way to improve reproductive health care for incarcerated people is for them not to be there. Right, and to receive care at community settings, and to be, you know, to be in their communities, and to have resources invested in communities. And so we wanted to have that broad vision of reproductive well-being. It's not only about reproductive health care while people are behind bars, but it's also part of that bigger picture. And yet, it is still important for us that we do work that does improve the quality and access to reproductive health care, because until that time comes, when people are not in prison or jail, people are dying, people are suffering, people are being shackled in childbirth, and we cannot ignore that only for the long-term vision of abolition. We also need to work on the now. And so our group does all kinds of research. Some of it is qualitative research. Some of it is quantitative research, survey research, engaging with policymakers, and also engaging with previously incarcerated women who, many of whom have started their own nonprofit organizations and are making waves, getting all kinds of state and federal legislation passed.
I love you, you know, making the distinction and tying things together between reproductive health, reproductive justice, reproductive well-being.
Yeah.
And after, you know, this being my second time seeing you in a meeting today, thinking about you made some important points this morning about the word complicity, and then you brought it to this conversation. So, I'm just, you know, enamored at the moment.
Thank you. Well, I hope that in The opening question of how I got here, what I'm hoping also came through, especially for listeners who may be students or otherwise in training, I hope that by telling you that story, which I didn't give you a sense of the time frame of it, between the time when I took that first anthropology course, oh, now I need to do the math if I'm not going to say the years, and when I got my PhD in anthropology, which was after medical school, after my residency training, that was 20 years. That was 20 years. And it's now been 8 years since my PhD. So all the work of the that I've described that you see that RWIP has been doing, and none of this happened overnight. I did not set out to study the intersections of reproductive justice and mass incarceration. It was, you know, situations that I found myself enmeshed in that then led me to ask questions and question assumptions that then led me down further paths. So again, if there are students or trainees listening here, you should feel reassured that you don't have to have it all figured out, and you will follow the paths of your, you know, what compels you and what makes you uncomfortable.
Slow and steady wins the race.
Yeah. Thank you so much for pointing that out, because I think for early career, anybody, you know, it's so easy to just see someone doing great work and having these accomplishments and just being like, oh, I'll never get there because, you know, they just arrived there and they haven't, you know, sometimes it just seems like some of these people have just spawned their careers where they're at. And so it's really helpful to have that kind of long history of your work and your inspiration. Okay, so I remember hearing NPR stories about women being shackled while giving birth. So I assume that it was you being interviewed in some of these, but of course I didn't know you then. And of course, you know, that narrative is such an important one, and it engenders so much justified anger at the system and, you know, the state violence that's being inflicted upon these women. But I also wanted to ask, what other issues are you dealing with in your work? And what other problems within the system do you think deserve that same level of media coverage, of outrage, et cetera?
I'm so glad you brought that nuance up, because we, of course, should be outraged, but it's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, it's such an obvious form of state violence, but it's exemplary of so many other things that happen. So again, I'm going to come back here and maybe just to give a little bit more information about the framework of reproductive justice, which, as I've already mentioned, or I've alluded to, there's, you know, a component of it about learning from these teachings as a white woman, because reproductive justice is a framework that emerged from and centers the experiences of Black women and others whose reproduction has been devalued and marginalized. And so the founders of reproductive justice and those who lead the movements, they emphasize that there are four core rights that are grounded in human rights principles. So as opposed to reproductive rights, which tends to be grounded in a civil rights notion of bodily autonomy, and that is the, you know, we should all have the right to choose. Well, the founders of reproductive justice were like, well, that's all nice, but all the other racist structures in our society don't even give us the option to choose. Choices foreclosed for us. And so recognizing the interconnection between the right not to have children, so the right to contraception and abortion, that's also connected to the right to have children. That is not equally distributed with coercive sterilization of certain individuals and populations that have been deemed undesirable, with a lack of access to quality prenatal care and, you know, very high disproportionate rates of maternal death among Black women and Indigenous women as well, and other people of color. And so reproductive justice, those are the first two right tenet, core tenets, the right not to have children, the right to have children, and the right to bodily autonomy. And then the fourth is the right to parent with dignity and in safe environments, and to have the material means to enact all those rights, the material supports and the institutional policies that don't support, but help those rights be enacted. So then coming back to what are the other things that we should have equal outrage for? Well, everything about mass incarceration in the U.S. disrupts those core tenets, whether it's unsafe birth through shackling or, you know, through ignoring of pregnant people's labor complaints to where they give birth in their jail cells, which is not a common occurrence, but it happens. At least there are media reports of a few cases a year. So it just has to be a non-zero number for us to be outraged. Whether it's preventing people who are incarcerated from consistent access to contraception and abortion. And, you know, the fourth right of being able to parent in dignity and in safe environments. Well, you can't parent in dignity and in safety if you're behind bars and your child is taken away from you and put in the foster care system or is otherwise separated from you. Or if you live in a community that is over-policed and where parents cannot be certain of the safety of their children from police and other forms of state violence. So everything about incarceration disrupts those core tenets of reproductive justice. And so I'll give two other specific examples related to that. One is abortion. And this is something that I know at least abortion in general is on many listeners' minds, given the recent Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Most people are probably, except for me, because this is what I do day in and day out, but most people are not thinking about how this impacts incarcerated individuals. And this was one of the first things on my mind, of course, though the first train of thought that I had was, how is this going to impact their abortion access? You know, people who are in prison or jail, and if they're in a state where abortion is banned, they don't have the freedom of movement to travel to another state. I mean, a lot of people, you know, they can't afford to, they can't get childcare. There are lots of complexities, but an incarcerated person doesn't even have the option to navigate and to try to do that. So abortion is foreclosed for those people. And then they are forced to give birth and continue a pregnancy in this environment where, you know, there are some prisons and jails that do provide, you know, a reasonable measure of prenatal care, but it's still prison. And many prisons and jails provide substandard or absent prenatal care. And then, you know, if they give birth while they're in custody, they're then forced to be separated from their newborns within hours or days. And so they're not allowed to not be pregnant because they're prevented from accessing abortion. And then they're not allowed to parent because they have to go through the trauma of giving up their child. So it's, you know, the punitive dimensions of this are so harsh. But it's not only about abortion and those kinds of consequences for incarcerated people. I soon began to realize it is. And also the situation for them was already pretty lousy before the Dobbs decision. So I've conducted both quantitative research on abortion policies and the occurrence, the frequency of abortions in prisons and jails. And I've also conducted qualitative interviews with pregnant folks behind bars about their thoughts about abortion and if they tried to get an abortion in prison and if anyone prevented them from it. And what we found in this research is that there are some prisons and jails that do allow abortion, that did and do allow abortion, but there might be other subtle barriers, like they have to pay for it themselves. They have to pay for overtime for the guards. Or there are some places that have unwritten or written policies that don't allow it, even though before Dobbs, that was illegal. It's just no one was paying attention. And then I interviewed some research participants who said that physicians at the jail coerced them into not getting, they said, oh, you shouldn't, don't have an abortion. That's wrong. I don't believe in abortion. You should not have an abortion, and impose their own views on abortion. There are probably also instances of people who were coerced to have abortions, but that didn't come up in our research, but I can imagine those are out there. And then I think one of the most striking things in this research, the qualitative research that we found, was that so many of the women we interviewed, when we asked them about, you know, if they tried to get an abortion or if they considered it, they just said very casually, matter-of-factly, oh, I just assumed I didn't have a right to an abortion because I'm incarcerated. And that is certainly true now for people, many people, but it was absolutely not true before June 24th. So they've internalized this, the sense that their reproduction and their choices, that's not something available to them. So anyway, the point of that was to share that research and those findings, but also to say that it was already a post-Roe reality in prisons. And so the marginal impact of now it being formalized and codified, we don't know what it's going to be, but it's maybe not as pronounced when it was already so bad. But I think what I'm concerned about is the ripple effect on other aspects of pregnancy care. I think we're going to see a lot more pregnant people in the United States in general. And so we're going to see more pregnant people behind bars. And these are systems that are already, you know, ill-equipped to handle the needs of pregnant and birthing and postpartum people. And so I think that's going to put a strain on the systems and further traumatize the women having to endure that. And then the last thing that I'll say about this potential other ripple effect is, you know, if a pregnant person who's in a prison or jail in an abortion restrictive state has a medical emergency and the prison or jail does everything right and takes them out to the hospital and says, whoa, this is a medical emergency. Someone's bleeding in pregnancy. They're having a miscarriage. We can't handle this here. They might go to a community hospital where they say, well, sorry, there's still a heartbeat. We can't do anything. And then send them back to the prison or jail. And prisons and jails don't want to, I mean, they don't want to be dealing with that. So I think we're going to see some issues, and it's the incarcerated individuals who are going to suffer.
I wanted to, and you might not have an answer for this yet, but I find it really intriguing that you mentioned the women who may have been coerced to have abortions. And I was wondering how you would even go about finding that out. But is that something that you plan to look into, women being coerced to terminate pregnancies within the system?
It's really hard to do research in incarcerated settings and with incarcerated individuals, especially. And so I would love to be able to study this. And, you know, it's something, yeah, it's possible, but methodologically, it would be challenging because my quantitative research found that there were so few abortions that happen in prisons. So we did the study where 22 state prisons, all federal prisons, and then the five largest jails reported on a monthly basis for 1 year, how many pregnant people came into their facilities, how many had miscarriages, births, abortions, ectopic pregnancies, other outcomes. And so what we found in that study is that at the 22 state prisons, and this was state level data, and all federal prisons, there were 11 abortions. 11. So it's not a lot. So to be able to like track all those 11, and it wasn't all 50 states, but all of the people down, and we certainly didn't have all the jails, but it would be very methodologically challenging. You know, one could find people who are in the community who have histories of incarceration and histories of abortion. But I think part of where that suspicion that this is happening comes from, for instance, the recognition of coercive sterilization procedures that happened very recently, especially in California, on incarcerated individuals. So if we know that people have been coerced to permanently cede their right to procreate, you know, it's not hard to make that leap that maybe someone was coercively, and coercion is, you know, sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's subtle. That's the point. A woman might not realize, usually they don't realize until after the fact, like, oh, wait, I didn't realize that's what I was signing up for. Or that doctor made me feel like I'm a terrible mother and that I don't deserve to have any babies. They might not see it in that way in the moment. They may, but that history of the sterilizations is one of the sources. And then the other, in my ethnographic research and in my book, Jail Care, one of the people who features prominently in this work is a woman I call Evelyn. And she had stories for me of previous pregnancies when she was in jail, of people who worked in the jail telling her that she needed an abortion, that she was having too many babies and not able to care for any of them. And so with this new pregnancy, she should have an abortion. And she was, you know, she's like, no way, I want to have this baby. And, you know, and she was able to identify the coercion and the undue pressure. Even though she could identify it, it was still so demoralizing.
This, of course, is making me think of that panel that you just moderated here at Hopkins about forced sterilization and the history of kind of eugenic thinking in reproduction. So we will link to that recording as well in the show notes, because I think a lot of these themes are really vibrant in their two talks as well.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to say, you know, when your book came out in 2017, it was my first year as a PhD student at UC San Francisco, and you came to give a talk. And I remember you describing how hard it was to do your ethnography while writing that book, playing like a, you know, subversive role and, you know, doing what you can to document what you can. So literally right before starting my PhD program in 2017, so from like February until I started in the fall, I taught classes at Folsom Prison. And one thing that sticks with me is how odd it was how prison administrators bragged about providing healthcare. Like, they're like, no one provides better healthcare than us in the entire state of California. And I just found that so strange, you know, like them bragging about, you know, in whatever way possible. But we were curious if you could talk more about how strange it is for places like jails and prisons, how they inhabit within, you know, wider American healthcare systems, thinking specifically, you know, how it is one of the few places where healthcare is considered, quote unquote, a right in a provided service, yet the carceral system is one that takes away most of those rights from, you know, its inhabitants.
Yes. And that is exactly one of the contradictions that drew me into this. And it's not a, you know, theoretical right for them. It's actually constitutionally established based on the Eighth Amendment and a Supreme Court case from 1976, Estelle versus Gamble, that incarcerated individuals have a constitutional right to health care, and that prisons and jails are constitutionally required to provide, the exact quote is, that deliberate indifference to the serious medical needs of prisoners constitutes the unwanted affliction of pain prescribed by the Eighth Amendment. So basically, to be deliberately indifferent, whatever that means, to serious medical needs, whatever that counts as, is cruel and unusual punishment. And yet, we don't have health care guaranteed as a right. And yet, when someone becomes incarcerated, they gain that right and lose so many of their others. And that's just one of the many contradictions. And I think what you said about the administrators at Folsom Prison, what they said, taps into another contradiction, which is that for many people, prison or jail may be the only place they get health care. And that is deeply problematic, right? That's a diagnosis of the failure of our healthcare systems outside the walls of prisons or jails, and a failure of our safety net systems. And in terms of that, the pride that person felt about the quality of their healthcare, you know, I can't speak to the quality of healthcare at Folsom Prison at all. And given that the California prison system was under receivership, their healthcare services were under federal receivership, you know, maybe it was a response to improvements from that. In any case, I think what's most interesting, and as an anthropologist and you both as historians, our insights and our questions that we ask are not, is it good? But where we go is, why are they saying that? What's behind that? And so what I find in just that anecdote you shared is, since that Estelle versus Gamble case, there's been the emergence of a field of professionalization within healthcare called correctional healthcare. Now, we can certainly talk about the problematics of that term correctional. And you know, I think the people who provide care in spaces of punishment, they are a wide and varied group. Someone like me, who used to work in a jail, and then someone like, I think Dr. Helmrich was his name at the California prison system, who said that, you know, women should get sterilizations so that they don't keep producing welfare babies. You know, so you get a whole gamut of physicians. But there is, you know, there are some who really take a lot of pride in the fact that they are caring for people that, you know, one of the nurses I worked with, who was part of my ethnographic research, he said, you know, society treats them as throwaways, and he used that language. But I don't see them as throwaways. You know, they're people who deserve care. And it makes me really proud to be the one who's providing care for them. And I wish that they could get better care on the outside, but this is how they're now I'm paraphrasing him. But this is the way our society is. And here I am in this place, and I want to provide good care to them. I'm not saying this is the administrator you spoke with, but I think there are some people who are in the system working in it and implicitly complicit. And yet they still have feelings of wanting people to be healthy and well, even if that's not fully possible in an carceral institution. There are many other people that, you know, where that comment about we've got the best healthcare, that might've also been coming from, I don't know if they deserve it. You know, look at what good services we're providing here. Do these people, do they really deserve it?
And that's exactly what I was going to say, because there was one gentleman who was incarcerated because he is an arsonist and he was getting dental work done and he was going to be released before they finished his dental work. And he said, I don't have any health care, so I want to stay here. Or can you speed up the process? And they said no. And he said, if you don't, then I'm going to set something on fire and I'm coming back to jail to have my dental work done. And that's exactly what he did.
Yeah, that's not the only time something like that has happened. You know, the woman I was talking about earlier, Evelyn, she had been in out of jail, you know, her whole adult life. But one of the times, you know, that she came in during a particular pregnancy, you know, she said she intentionally turned herself into the cops patrolling the corner because she's like, I'm 32 weeks pregnant. I'm exhausted. I've got nothing to eat. I've got no place to put my head down. And I know what's up in jail. It's not great, but I know what I'm going to get there. And, you know, I'll get some prenatal care. I'll have a place to lay my head. So she turned herself in for that, some version of care, which is, of course, tied to violence, right? It's still incarceration. And so that again, and that individual setting something on fire so that he could complete this necessary dental work, that is such a scathing indictment of the failures of our society. No one should want to go to prison or jail. We also can't ignore desire, right? And that's something I explore in my book, is desire, like carceral desire. And it's not uniform. This is not a common thing. But again, with anthropology and with other fields of, you know, humanities and social medicine inquiry and social sciences, you know, sometimes those outliers are where you learn much about contradictions and what's keeping our society going and keeping it inequitable. And so somebody setting fire to get dental work, you know, that's right. That shouldn't happen. Our community systems should not allow that to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, I'm surprised by these stories, but then at a deeper level, like not surprised at all, you know, the fact that that's not surprising at all is really disheartening. You mentioned earlier some being under federal receivership. Could you explain what that means?
I'm not a legal scholar, so I don't know if I'll do it justice, but it's an entity created by a judge that's overseen, I think, by the courts. So in this case, it was for healthcare delivery. And so the receivership in California, the decisions about healthcare services and hiring, they were made by the people running and employed by the receivership, not by people in the Department of Corrections.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot more sense. I think we're going to start to segue towards the end of the interview. I mean, we started thinking about the discipline that you work in, medical anthropology, but I kind of want to segue back to thinking about the disciplines that this podcast deals with based in the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine. And I know that your work is more on the social medicine side rather than the medical humanities side. So I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about how you see these two fields as different, but in conversation with one another, and what kind of value they both might bring to practice and debates in medicine today.
Yeah, they're very much aligned and also divergent in some ways. And at the most, basic isn't quite the right word, but obvious level, the ways in which they diverge are just the methods and the disciplines that are contained within. And while it's not a strict distinction, medical humanities usually doesn't include sociology and anthropology, whereas those more commonly fall under social medicine. It can, but the humanities, you know, disciplines are history and art and literature, narrative medicine, and others as well. So I think some of it is disciplinary and the methods that go along with those disciplines. And yet the reasons why they're often aligned in similar departments or centers like the Johns Hopkins Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine is that both fields and the disciplines that fall under them, what they do is they are all grounded in ideas that we should question our assumptions about why things are the way they are, how they became the way things are, can we imagine alternatives, and, you know, and paying attention to those ends of one, you know, and what we can learn about humanity, what we can learn about beauty, what we can learn about harm, about inequities, what we can learn about the human condition, and going about that through questioning what we take for granted. And similarly, I think what they both offer and why I think it's so valuable for people who are healthcare professionals to engage with these disciplines is that it forces you to reckon with nuance and uncertainty. And, you know, in our fields, in history and in anthropology, we don't try to resolve uncertainties. You know, that's where the excitement is in a lot of ways. We want to know, you know, how things got to this way and why are they uncertain and what are the tensions? And that happens all the time in clinical medicine. There is so much uncertainty, and many people aren't willing to admit that. Many practitioners and patients don't really want to know that there is uncertainty, but there's uncertainty all the time in healthcare, in medicine, in medical decision making. No matter what kind of a p-value you associate with a treatment, all knowledge is partial. There's always nuance and uncertainty.
I just hear the Foucault, you know, emanating. It's just jumping out of you.
You know, as problematic as he was and his ideas, some of his ideas are, and his approach as a white European male philosopher from the metropole, as problematic as that positionality and some of his works are, he is still so useful. Mm-hmm.
I tweeted the other day, or a couple of weeks ago, I was writing a chapter that I'm working on. Is there any worse realization than realizing that the thing that you're working on needs more Foucault?
And I was just like, I can't believe I have to do this. Like, I don't want to put more of him in this, but it's useful. Yeah. The frameworks are useful.
In fact, Foucault's definition of critique, I used to have it, you know, right in front of me on my desk. Maybe the post-it note fell, but his definition of critique is so perfect and so valuable. I'll paraphrase it. Maybe some of the things I'll get right, but a critique is not a matter of saying things are wrong the way they are. It's a matter of questioning why things are the way they are, what processes and assumptions got us there. And I just love that he's very clear that critique we shouldn't think of it as something that automatically has a negative valence. It's about questioning. And I just find that such a guiding light in the work that I do.
Yeah. One of my favorite scholars, Robin D.G. Kelly, like he said, our survival, like that's why we critique one another for our own survival. We got to figure it out and get it right. Like we can go down a scholar rabbit hole, but I'm curious, you know, what other, you know, scholars helped you in not just writing Jail Care, but, you know, thinking like a medical anthropologist, like an OBGYN, you know, who are some of the scholars whose work you engage with that helped you strengthen your argument, understand how things operate, come to draw certain conclusions? And are there any other emerging scholars whose work you're looking forward to?
I love that question. There are so many people whose scholarship has and continues in new ways to inspire my thinking. And some of the people that come to mind, specifically from anthropology, Ian Whitmarsh, who is one of my dissertation advisors, and he was so good at pushing me to think about that you can think about care and violence together in ways beyond what Foucault said, which is, you know, and people who follow in those footsteps, that all care is violent, that there's more there. There's more there to the intersubjectivity of it and the existential nature of care, that we can't automatically assume all care that coexists with violence is inherently violent. So he has really been central to my being willing to go to that kind of scary place, right? Because it's hard to not have that come across as saying, and then care in jail is good, right? That's not the point, right? So he's been hugely influential. Angela Garcia is another medical anthropologist who writes about a lot of things, especially intergenerational heroin addiction and settler colonialism. Lorna Rhodes, who's an anthropologist who wrote about, she's retired now, mental health care and mental illness in prisons. And then, of course, what scholar isn't influenced, at least what scholar who even remotely thinks about race and reproduction is not influenced by Dorothy Roberts. Her work just, you know, across the decades has been and continues, you know, everything new that comes out, it just, you know, it's something more that I learned from her. Loretta Ross, one of the founding mothers of reproductive justice. Monica McLemore, I've learned a lot from her. Lisa Stevenson is a cultural anthropologist who has done work with Indigenous communities in Canada related to high rates of suicide and the ways that that's connected to state violence and settler colonialism, and also the state's response to it through suicide hotlines and various interventions that kind of are grounded in some ways in notions of care, but still tied to colonial forms of violence. You know, care and anthropology of care, these are things that, of course, medical anthropologists have long been interested in, but it's really hard to define care, right? And there is no singular definition. I'm not going to try to define it because there shouldn't be. But Lisa Stevenson's way of thinking about care is something that I keep coming back to again and again. And very simply, I mean, there's more to this quote than the few words I'm about to say, but she writes about care as the way someone comes to matter, right? How does someone come to matter in this world and become visible and valued by institutions, systems, or by another person, or by a caregiver, you know, the way someone comes to matter. I just think that's a really inclusive way of thinking about care that allows for all the polyvalence of its meaning, its harms, its benefits, all of those things. Another person whose work, especially at the intersection of reproductive justice and carcerality, is Michelle Goodwin, who's a legal scholar at UC Irvine. And then for an emerging scholar, I would like to give a shout out to Dr. Crystal Hayes. She is a licensed clinical social worker who now also has her doctorate in social work. And she also is doing research at the intersection of reproductive injustice and mass incarceration. So stay tuned for more of her work coming on the scene.
You said what we can look forward to is some of these other scholars that you admire. What can we look forward to in terms of what you're working on right now? What are your new projects or future projects?
Well, I am hoping to do a project related to the impact of the Dobbs decision on incarcerated people. And I'm still working out the methods and the funding and how that's going to happen. But I've already shared with you a slice of some of the things I'm thinking of and how it relates to my past work on how we think about, you know, people being punished through their pregnancies. So that's one area. I also have been working through some of the issues I alluded to at the very beginning about complicity with systems of harm. And I have a piece coming out soon in Culture, Medicine, and Society, where I connect some of these ideas and bring in some ethnographic examples of my work in the San Francisco jail and how I've stayed in touch with some of those people. But I work through what does it mean to be complicit in systems of harm and working inside of them. And I come at this through two insider statuses. One is, you know, working as a doctor inside a jail, and the other is being a clinician ethnographer and being a doctor inside a hospital. Right? These are two systems of harm, hospitals and jails. And I begin from a place where it's not, am I complicit? The starting point is absolutely, can't deny that, can't disavow it. But what work can be done, what can be productive in that space of complicity? That's not about guilt. That's not about just wallowing in the guilt or leaving those institutions, which is an option. But that having that position and being complicit and sitting with that discomfort of complicity, it can do things. It can do things to change your understandings of these systems, and potentially, not that I would have the solutions or ideas of how to change them. I wouldn't center myself in that, but it can give insights that could support abolition efforts, for instance, both medical abolition and also carceral abolition. And so I work through what some of that complicity can do and how to be with it and not to be comfortable with it, but what can the discomfort with that complicity do? What can it enable? So those are some of the things I'm working on, you know, always thinking about the intersections of these systems and you know, my unusual positionality, not unique. There are others. I'm not the only physician ethnographer out there. I'm not the only person working at the intersection of mass incarceration and reproduction. But what can this vantage point that I'm positioned in, you know, where does that take me? Where does that take me?
Completely reminds me of the Howard Zinn quote, "You can't stand still on a moving train." That's exactly what came to me.
I have never heard that quote, and that is brilliant. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to seeing that journal article out and hearing more about, you know, your work on the impact of the Dobbs decision. I think that's all from us. Thank you so, so much. No, that was really, you know, a really inspiring conversation. And
thank you.